Wake up! Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. You are now listening to You and Me at 30. I'm your host, Dr. Joshua K. Wright. I realize that you could be anywhere in the world right now, but you're here listening to me, and I sincerely appreciate that. You and Me at 30 is a talk show bringing you lively, thought-provoking discussion on a variety of topics. Each show will feature an extended conversation with a guest. While many of these individuals will come from the University of Maryland Eastern Shore and the local community, I will also feature several guests from around the country. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of 91.3 WESM or the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. My guest this morning is Sean Gregory, a senior sports writer for Time Magazine. Since joining Time in 2002, Sean has written profiles of a wide range of athletes, including Usain Bolt, LeBron James, Tim Tebow, Novak Djokovic, and Maria Sharapova. He wrote Time's 2010 cover story on the concussion crisis in football and has written enterprise features on the Penn State football child sex scandal, baseball in the Dominican Republic, the recruiting of preteen athletes by major college sports programs, and the competitiveness of amputee golfers. He has also covered four Olympic Games, as well as multiple Super Bowls, World Series, and NBA Finals. Sean, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
No problem, Josh. Thanks for having me here.
Last August, you wrote Time's cover story on women's tennis champion Serena Williams. What was it like interviewing Serena, and was there one thing that you learned in that interview that surprised you?
I went out there in San Jose between Wimbledon and the start of the U.S. Open, and she had made the finals at Wimbledon coming back from a harrowing pregnancy. It was a very big story. People wanted to know how she was feeling, how she did it, and so we were lucky enough to get some time with her. The issue that happened was out in San Jose, I spoke to her before a tune-up tournament for about 40 minutes, but we were supposed to do a really in-depth interview after. And then she lost in the first round. She really got destroyed. It was the worst loss of her career out in San Jose. And so I was worried, well, she might not be in the mood to talk. And what was surprising was it took a few days, but she really wanted to open up, and she really wanted to talk and share the experience of, you know, going through the tough pregnancy and the details of it and what she went through on the road back. And what was really eye-opening to me and surprising was, you know, she didn't talk about it after the match, but word had gotten out that the man who had killed her half-sister years ago in a case of mistaken identity in Compton had just been released from prison. And she had found out that news before the match where she got obliterated, and obviously she was distracted. And so I kind of gingerly brought it up, and she wanted to talk about it. She talked about forgiveness. She talked about themes of how she was feeling and whether she was ready to forgive this person or not. And so during a quiet moment in her car, she just kind of, for the first time, really opened up about it.
Yeah, and on that note, so when you're sitting down with a Serena Williams, a LeBron James, a Usain Bolt, what's your approach to interviewing these high-profile individuals?
A lot of times you're time-crunched, right? So these are very, very busy people, some of the most famous people in the world. So when you get time for one-on-one interviews, a lot of times, you know, you have to really strategize. You have to, what I do a lot is I write a list of questions in priority order and then write them down like three or four times on a piece of paper and try to just drill them in my head. So I know that as you're going along, all right, this line of questioning isn't working. Where can I go quick that maybe changes things up? So you have to really kind of figure out, all right, if it's, you know, 20 minutes in, or I got 10 minutes left, what do I really want to get to of what I haven't gotten to yet? All that kind of stuff. But once you're sitting down with somebody, you know, they're famous, but it sounds hokey, but it's just two people talking, and that's really what you want to get to.
Do they normally have the questions in advance so they could at least think about it beforehand, or is it?
No.
Okay, so it's right on the
spot. Yeah, no, that's a great question, and we go back and forth on it. Some folks ask for that, and it's our policy not to do that, not for ambush purposes, but we want to keep it as a conversation. I think these folks are so busy that we worry that, like, if we send them a list of questions, you know, their publicist will kind of dictate what they should say, but we want to get the honest truth of the person.
How difficult is it to write stories like the one she did on the concussions in the NFL or the Penn State sex scandal, where, you know, you had the potential to tarnish beloved sports leagues, coaches like Joe Paterno, or universities with these stories.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, you're going against big institutions who want to tell a very different story or spin a very different truth than what might be the actual story and the actual truth. So, you know, the Penn State example was, you know, I went out there right after it all broke, and the day I got there, the day after Paterno was fired, and there were riots the night before. It was a very toxic place. You can just kind of feel the toxic nature of it. And, you know, I was going around talking to people about how they felt, and you know, a lot of students and faculty were angry. Others were thought that you know, the media was overblowing this and all this stuff. And you just got to write what, you know, you got to call it as you see it. Don't get anything wrong. But if the underlying facts are true, you know, you're on solid ground.
So recently we had the NBA draft, and we saw Zion Williams taken as the number one pick. And, you know, they're already talking about, is this kid going to be a superstar from day one because of all the hype that he received, not just at the college level, but all the hype he was receiving as a high school student. And that gets me to a bigger issue of youth sports in America. HBO's Real Sports series did an episode about youth sports, and they talked about how the nation's wealth gap is making youth sports an uneven playing field, where, you know, certain kids who don't come from families of means can't play sports or may not be able to play sports in the future. You did an article some years back about, well, it was titled How Kids Sports became a $15 billion industry. And I've heard you in interviews, and I've read the article, and, you know, you said some really interesting tidbits about families being broken apart because of youth sports tournaments and different things. So if you can, just kind of elaborate and give your thoughts about the state of youth sports in America.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, because it's a huge issue. And when we did that cover story 2 summers ago, just got a ton of reaction. Youth sports has become professionalized. There are, you know, companies that run tournaments every weekend, and it's a machine, right? And there's, you know, I hate to say when I was young, but when I was growing up playing basketball in New York City, there were two travel teams, AAU teams, whatever you want to call it. There are basically two in the city. Now there are 200 at least, because, you know, entrepreneurs have seen an opening where, all right, I'm going to start a team and anybody can play. You pay, you know, $500 for the season, $1,000 for the season, whatever it is. You get 15 kids, and it's a profitable enterprise. And there are cities that are towns across America that are building huge facilities to host tournaments and seeing it as an economic development tool. You mentioned breaking up family. And I'm living this a little bit with my son who plays travel basketball. Is, you know, there's what team you're going to play for. How are we going to get him to practice? You know, we want to do something this weekend, but he has 3 games this weekend, and it's a huge drain in your brain space. You'd spend a lot of time managing this stuff and the financial commitments too. So, and it could cause, it definitely could cause tension within families. Like, I don't want to do this anymore. Dad wants to do it. Mom wants to do it, but doesn't want to do it, vice versa. So, and we spoke to, and as you mentioned, athletes, families where, you know, it caused real marital tension and stuff and family tension.
I do have one final question about the youth sports before we move on. Do you think that there's a danger, though, when these kids become, you know, I started out by mentioning Zion Williams, and, you know, we think about how much money a kid like that could generate for a travel team, a high school, and then later a college. I mean, is there, do you feel like we're kind of like crossing that line, or have we already crossed the line where this starts to become dangerous and kids start to get exploited because of the dollar signs that are involved with this?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, and that starts with the, you know, the NCAA rules against amateurism rules, where, you know, Zion Williamson can't get paid until he's drafted. But, you know, Zion Williamson could have, and there are stories out there that maybe there have been under the table payments and stuff. But, you know, Zion Williamson, he's such a talent. But, you know, when he's 14, 15, 16 years old, whenever he started doing his Instagram dunking on everybody across the country, you know, he who's getting, you know, at that point, it's the shoe companies are trying to monetize him. It's the coach, maybe the coaches trying to monetize his talent. But none of the money flows to him, right? Because, you know, in theory, none of the money's supposed to flow to him because he's not supposed to make any money until he, quote unquote, turns professional. So, yeah, there's definitely, as these youth athletes become, quote unquote, bigger stars at a young age, who's trying to profit off them? Because we have this system where, you know, a Zion Williamson, unlike, you know, European soccer players, they can sign contracts, their families can sign contract, professional contracts when they're much, much younger and go to these academies and stuff. Here, we don't have that system. What my, you know, my biggest concern, people don't know how hard it is to get a college scholarship. And so there's a lot of families whose kids are decent basketball, football players, whatever, at 11 and 12 years old who have, you know, money signs, you know, in their eyes thinking, my kid's going to get a college scholarship. My kid's going to do whatever it takes to get a college scholarship. 2% of high school athletes get college scholarships. And so, and a kid who's 12 years old, you don't know what's going to happen between 12 and 17. The kid might not grow. He might burn out in basketball. He might, you know, go to a school where there's another kid better than him. So I think my fear of this whole professionalization of youth sports is the, and, you know, hyping of these young athletes is there are a lot of parents who think that their kid's going to get a college scholarship when their kid's 12 and 13 years old. They don't realize that the odds of that happening are very, very, very small.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to UMES 30. Today's guest is Mr. Sean Gregory, a senior sports writer for Time Magazine. Sean, do you select the stories that you write about, and do you have a favorite story?
Yeah, mostly the stories that I get, I wind up doing are my ideas. They come from me, and then, but I can't just go out and do it. That goes through an approval process where I have an editor that I work particularly closely with who I'll pitch him something or mention something. And then if he thinks it's a good idea, I'll go and do it. And then my favorite, I don't know if I had a favorite, but just some notables was, it's not a favorite. It wasn't a happy story. It was a story about a high school football player who died. This was 6 years ago. And we wanted to tell, you know, there have been a lot of headlines about the safety of football and kids, you know, banging heads and being severely injured or in some cases passing away because of these incidents. And so there's some stats out there, and we wanted to say, well, listen, let's tell the story of one of these families. What happened going in? What was the aftermath and how these families feel about football? And I met a family in Missouri who, after, you know, a lot of back and forth and building trust, decided to share their story of their son, Chad Stover, in Tipton, Missouri, who during a game on Halloween, you know, had a head-to-head contact that didn't look that bad. And then all of a sudden, you know, went unconscious on the field and they rushed into a hospital. And 7 days later, he died. And so it was a very emotional story, very tough story, spending a week with these good folks kind of, you know, really going through what happened and them being honest and talking about tough things and spending hours in the living rooms and shedding a lot of tears. And but it was, they wanted to do it because they wanted to just kind of share the experience. And their underlying message was like, football's done a lot of good, but we got to do more to make it safer, which was a very reasonable message. So, and it wound up being on the cover. And to our credit, you know, Time had never had a high school football player who nobody ever heard of who, you know, unfortunately lost his life on the cover. I mean, that's not exactly, you know, a cover that you'd expect. And our executives, Nancy Gibbs, who ran Time at the time, had the gumption to put that story on the cover. And so that was particularly gratifying. And if there's something, maybe there's a number one that kind of stands out, it might be that because of, you know, just how much impact it had.
One of the things that fascinates me whenever I talk to people like yourself who are very successful is, you know, number one, how you all find time to juggle all of the demands, you know, that you have professionally with your personal life. And then also how you're able to stay humble and then also stay motivated to keep working hard and not just rest on your laurels and get comfortable and say, oh, well, I did this 3 years ago, so now I could kind of just coast.
Yeah, I mean, I think the nature of work, and particularly this kind of work, you can't rest on your laurels. It's a very, what if, you know, journalism is a very you know, what have you done for me lately kind of business. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I could have written something. The Serena Williams story was, you know, very successful, and but I can't just rest on that for a year and say, hey, I did that a year ago and do not, you know, I have to keep producing. It's publish or perish, man, you know, and that kind of keeps you going.
So, Sean, when you were a kid, did you grow up dreaming about doing this for a profession? Like, take me through that journey from when you were a kid to where you are today. How'd you get to this point in life?
I had an uncle, the late Jim O'Connell, who was the head college basketball writer for the Associated Press for years. He passed away last summer. You know, very well respected in the basketball community. I was very lucky. He was my aunt's husband, my father's sister's husband, and I saw him every Christmas, spent a lot of time around him, and I was like, wait a second, this guy gets to go to college basketball game, gets paid for it. So that, I was very lucky that from a young age, I had sports journalism. I was exposed to it firsthand. And then, so that was always in the back of my head. When I went to college, I played on the basketball team, and the problem with that was that a lot of journalists coming out of college spent 4 years writing for their school paper. Still the case, but particularly like the late 90s, in that era where there was the digital revolution hadn't really started. There were no blogs. You know, students didn't have blogs and stuff like that. You know, you had to write for your school newspaper to get a journalism job out of college. I just couldn't do that. I wanted to play ball. We had, we were pretty good. I wasn't ready to quit basketball to join the school paper full time. I wrote for the school paper here and there, but I didn't have enough experience to get a job out of college. So out of college, I wound up working for an investment bank on Wall Street just because it was a job, and it was the 90s and the economy was good. I was like, all right, let's see what this finance thing's all about. Maybe I can make a lot of money and be happy. And from like day one, I was miserable. It was just like, what am I doing here? I should be a sports journalist. And I regretted right away not pursuing that dream. But I stayed at the firm for 3 years and wound up going to Columbia Journalism School, which was a good place for career changers. And once I was in journalism school, I was like, all right, I'm going to be a journalist. I got to give it a try. I was in my mid-20s. I was like, if I don't do it now, I'm never going to do it. And I got hired as an intern at Time because, amusingly enough, they thought I was a business expert because I'd worked at the Wall Street firm. And it was during the time when like all these accounting, it was like Enron and all these accounting firms, 2002, were having all these scandals. So they thought, oh, this guy knows accounting. He can help us out. I really didn't know much about accounting. Right. So I kind of fooled them. And I got hired and did some business stories because that was a way to get in the magazine, and then saw an opportunity for sports because Time didn't really have any sports coverage. And I was like, listen, you know, sports is important. I know you don't have somebody doing it. I'll do it. I was young. I was cheap. And then they just gave me a chance to do it. And that's how it all started.
And you I know you mentioned Pete Carrell earlier. So you played college ball at Princeton, correct?
I did. I don't want to overstate my talent. I was on the team for 4 years. I was a reserve player. Didn't play a ton, but you know, met some really good friends, and you know, don't regret sticking with it for 4 years, even though I didn't see the court much at all.
Okay, and then you also, in addition to writing for Time, I know you've done stories with Sports Illustrated, and then you did you work with WFAN? The Fan out of New York.
I did. That was in the summer. Yeah. I mean, through my uncle, you know, I'm very lucky having my uncle in my life because he introduced me to some folks from FAN. I thought at some point I wanted to be a sports broadcaster. I did some color commentary and play by play for the student radio station at Princeton, but not enough to where I could send out a tape and say, hey, hire me as your AAA baseball announcer. Or AA baseball announcer. That's how folks get started in that industry. But I knew some folks where I was able to, you know, do some kind of production stuff at WFAN and meet some people. It was a great experience. It was cool. I met some great people. But I realized at that point, I kind of realized I had more talent as a writer than as a broadcaster. My voice wasn't, you know, like Marv Albert or anything like that. You need a distinguished broadcast voice. And I think with work, it could have worked out. But I saw an easier route in writing than broadcasting, and I think I made the right choice.
So speaking of writing, with athletes having a greater voice these days, thanks to platforms such as the Players Tribune and Uninterrupted, do you think that traditional sports journalism will eventually become obsolete? And we've heard these stories over the years now about journalism dying, the newspaper and print industry dying. So what's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, the Uninterrupted and
Players Tribune as a journalist, don't love them. I mean, they've done some great stuff, and I give those folks credit. I give LeBron credit. I give Jeter credit. They're saying, the athletes are saying, it's our stories. We want to control our own narrative. How can we do this? We can deliver. We don't need the middleman anymore. And I get that. And they're right. And in many cases, don't blame them for making those investments. It's made our lives more difficult because, you know, it's harder to get time with a LeBron James because now he says, all right, why should I spend time with a journalist who's going to write the story? I want to write my own story. I want to tell my own story. I totally get it. At the same time, I don't think journalism is going to become obsolete because readers kind of can see through what's branding, what's advertising, and what's real, what are really, really, really great stories. And I'm obviously biased, but I think at the end of the day, journalists telling story, the full story, journalists are in a position where, all right, LeBron has something he wants to say. You interview him, you get that part of the, you know, you get what he says about it. But then you speak to other players, you speak to coach, you speak to all these folks around the story who could give additional insight that if it's just coming from LeBron, you're not going
to
get.
Sean, not to cut you off, but you know that's a criticism of his television show on HBO, The Shop. A lot of people feel like it's just him and his buddies agreeing with each other for 20 minutes and not really giving you, you know, a more in-depth discussion on these topics they're bringing up.
I think you're right. I mean, yeah, people see through that. I mean, you know, LeBron fans see through that. I mean, I see ESPN promoting that all the time. It's LeBron and his friends. And some of that stuff is great. So they have honest conversation. LeBron talks in a way, like in a colorful language that he might not necessarily do with somebody he doesn't know. But, yeah, there's a lot of folks just agreeing with each other for 20 minutes on TV. How compelling is that? I think both forms can exist. There are some legacy outlets, and I'll be biased and say Time for one. Like, the cover of Time means something still. I mean, athletes will make time to be on the cover of Time. We saw that with Serena, saw that recently with Alex Morgan, have seen it with other athletes. So traditional legacy media still has, I think, enough influence where you can get, you know, rich, layered, textured stories. And I don't think that's going away anytime in the immediate future.
You know, I see a lot of sports journalists now going into cable television, and you have a growing number of debate shows popping up all over the place on ESPN, on Fox Sports, et cetera. As a journalist, I mean, what do you think about these debate shows? Will we see you on a debate show every day from 3 to 3:30 one day in the near future?
I don't think so. For a few reasons, the journalists who tend to be on the debate shows really have strong opinions, really follow the day to day goings on of free agency and who's pitching and coaching changes and schedule. You know, I give those folks a lot of credit. There's a lot you have to know you can't fake. Me, I'm someone who's kind of covering less the day-to-day, you know, free agency maneuvers and pitching decisions and you know, who should start a quarterback for this team or that team. I cover more the big picture, big impact type stories that, you know, these folks talk about, but I'm not steeped in the day-to-day kind of transactional nature of the sports debate show. So I don't think I would be both my knowledge set and my kind of outgo, you know, like I'm not a screamer. I don't think I don't have a big opinion presence.
So you recently started teaching at Columbia University's graduate school. How's that going?
It's great, Josh. I did it for the first time this spring, and it was a course I took when I was a student there. So particularly honored to be able to keep it going. And, you know, I co-taught it with Kelly Whiteside, who was a college sports and Olympics reporter for years at USA Today. She's now a contributor to the New York Times and a teacher at Montclair State and a teacher at Columbia. It's fun. You know, we got some guests come in. We had some really interesting guests. Bomani Jones from ESPN came in to talk about activism and race in sports. We had Pablo Torre from ESPN to talk about writing. He was a great writer before he became a sports debate guy, and a bunch of other really prompt. Jeremy Schaaf from ESPN did a TV story. So we had some, the nice part about it was that sports journalists really want to give back and help the future generation. So we were able to get some folks to come into the studio, you know, talk to the students. the hat experience that Kelly and I don't have. We're not, you know, we're not on TV, and you know, we're both white, and so we couldn't speak to, you know, from a personal level, some of the racial implications of Colin Kaepernick and other stuff like that. So we were able to get some diverse group of speakers to come in and hopefully enlighten and speak to the class. And we wanted, the message you want to get across to them is, you know, it's hard work.
Well, my cousin Kofi Yeboah graduated from the University of Maryland College Park School of Journalism as an undergrad about 2 years ago. And this summer he's going to New York. He has a job with the blogging site SB Nation. And he had a question that he wanted me to ask you. So I'm going to ask this.
Sure.
The question is, what advice would you give someone seeking some amount of stability in such an unstable industry?
Yeah. You know, become the go-to person on something that people care about. And that's not easy, right? I mean, yeah, I think that's where how you have to kind of think. And because, you know, if you have a unique skill set and you can build an audience around that, I think that's how I would be thinking if I were young and trying to survive in an unstable. It's an unstable business. There are audiences out there to be had if you present the right product.
Is there any way listeners can find your articles or follow you on social media?
Yes. My Twitter is Sean M. Gregory, at Sean, S-E-A-N M. Gregory. There was another Sean Gregory. I had to put the M. So S-E-A-N M. Gregory. That's my Twitter follow. I'm on time.com.
My final question, if you could interview anyone outside the sports world, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
Barack Obama just came to my head. I just think to sit with him now and to talk about politics and sports, you know, talk about how he sees what's changed in the world since he left office, his thoughts on 2020, his thoughts on the current president, what he's done and hasn't done, and how it might, you know, is the current president reversing his legacy or not? How did, you know, all kinds of questions that you or I, anybody would want to ask him. But then for him also, you know, the basketball side of it, he stopped playing basketball because he's afraid, you know, he was afraid of getting hurt while in office. Was that tough? You know, like I think he was, when he was playing, he was in his early 50s, I think, still playing. I'm 43. I would hope to still be playing in my early 50s. I love playing the game. It's great exercise. It's fun. Like, how did he do it? How did he not get hurt? You know, he's now, I believe he's invested in the NBA's expansion in Africa. He's going to be part of that somehow. What is the opportunity there? Does he want to start a league there? Could there be an NBA development team there? Can there be an NBA team there overseas? Would he want to be commissioner one day? And he's obviously loves sports, loves basketball.
Sean, thank you so much again for joining me today.
No problem, Josh. Thanks for having me here.
And that's our show for the week. Thanks again to our guests. We do this every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. If you like the show, please tell your friends about it. Like us on Facebook and social media. A special shout out, as always, to Uncle Phil and Aunt Viv. Have a blessed day.
Listen to this or any past episode of UMES 30 by logging on to WESM913.org or through the NPR One app available for download on Google Play. UMES 30 is produced in the studios of 91.3 WESM, located on the campus of the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. The views and opinions expressed on UMES 30 are not necessarily those of 91.3 WESM or the University of Maryland Eastern Shore.